If you could save yourself, you could save us all. Go on living. Prove us wrong. That's Jawbreaker. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jays Talk Plus. The Toronto Blue Jays in a situation where they need to prove a lot of people wrong. Not to say that one game is an entire series or an entire season, but coming off of a 5-1 week against lesser competition, coming off a stretch of games where you did pad your record and crawl closer to 500 against the Chicago White Sox and Pittsburgh Pirates of the league, this is a lie detector test series against the Baltimore Orioles. And the first little blip on that polygraph is that the Jays are not telling the truth with that 5-1 week, with that crawl back toward 500. They lose 7-2 yesterday. Within that game, we got a Pete Walker ejection for arguing balls and strikes, gives a thumbs up to the umpire with a big smile on the way out. We got the franchise record for first inning drought extended to 25 games. They are now two games off of joining the top five longest first inning droughts in the history of baseball, at least back to 1901 when we first have data. We got another shaky Kevin Gausman outing. He had posted a 2.80 ERA over his last eight starts coming into this one, but hadn't always, you know, felt like his stuff was there to hear him tell it. You know, stats wise, you know, the whiffs were down and things like that outside of the Detroit game. And yeah, the Orioles got to him. The Orioles did what the Orioles do, and they swing for damage, and they, yeah, they do a lot of damage. That's basically it. On the other side, the Jays once again couldn't get anything going. We talked before the game about how with this Orioles team, especially with Grayson Rodriguez and Corbin Burnes starting the series with a four-game series where the Orioles are in the middle of a condensed schedule, they're doing the 13th pitching man roster churn because they don't have enough bullpen arms and they don't have enough quality bullpen arms, that it was paramount to get deeper into that bullpen early. Grayson Rodriguez had his longest start of the season. He threw for the 33rd consecutive start of his major league career. That is every single major league start he's made. A fastball on the first pitch of the game. It was right over the heart of the plate. That zone percentage on that first pitch is up over 50% as well. Jays didn't do anything with that. Jays didn't do much in general other than a Vladimir Guerrero Jr. home run that got out of the deepest part of the ballpark, caused the center fielder to crash into the wall, caused the sound issue on the broadcast for a second. It sounded like things were clanging around. But that was basically it. Dalton Varsho had an RBI triple, but the Jays couldn't get much done on the offensive side once again. So it's a 7-2 loss, pushes the Jays back down to three games under 500. And yeah, it puts a lot of pressure on tonight's game where Corbin Burnes will go up against a TBA. This is the Alek Manoah spot. Alek Manoah, of course, on the IL. We presume some combination of Bowden Francis, Trevor Richards, etc. Let's break it all down with the voice of the Toronto Blue Jays, Dan Schulman. Dan, good morning, man. How are you?
Good morning, Blake. How you doing?
I am well. So it's only one game of the series, but you guys teed it up. You know, you and Buck teed it up last night. Buck had a really great and kind of passionate monologue off the top about how much this series means and coming off of playing teams like the White Sox and Pittsburgh and kind of padding your record that way, that we learn a lot about this team in this series. I've kind of called it, you know, a BS detector series. How are you feeling about that after the first missive here?
Well, before we go there, I mean, and you're right, how great was he in the open?
Yeah.
I mean, we got off and like I just looked at him like with my jaw dropped and went, damn, like that was amazing what he said, because he said what everybody is feeling and he's got, you know, he's got the status to say it. So, you know, every series is big. I don't know specifically that this is any bigger than another series unless they go out and get, you know, if they get beat four in a row, then the standings are the standings, right? You can't live in denial on that. So, you know, this last stretch where they went 8-5 over 13, that was okay. But those were playing weaker teams, and you would have liked to have seen a 9-4, maybe even a 10-3. But you're right. Tonight's game is big. If they lose it, now you got to beat them two in a row just to split the series. And splitting with Baltimore is fine because, let's be honest, Baltimore is a really, really good team. They're a better team than the Blue Jays are right now. But, yeah, you lose tonight, you put a lot of pressure on yourselves to try to win the next two. And but, you know as well as I do, winning tonight is not going to be easy. Corbin Burnes is one of the best starting pitchers in baseball, and the Blue Jays will have to have great at-bats and get some good pitching if they're going to win this game.
So before we turn the page to the Corbin Burnes start, and yeah, that's you thought Grayson Rodriguez had stuff. Well, guess what? They're right next to each other in the stuff plus ranking. So more stuff coming your way tonight, Blue Jays lineup. One of the things that stood out in yesterday's game, and you guys talked about this on the broadcast, you know, this is a series where, short of maybe playing the Yankees later this month, this is where the Jays' inability to hit home runs and their inability to keep the ball in the yard for the other team is going to be most prevalent. The Jays are 25th in home runs and 28th in home runs allowed. They've allowed 25 more home runs than they've hit. The Orioles at the kind of opposite end of those, second in home runs hit, fifth in home runs allowed. They're plus 37. So we're talking about like a 62 home run swing in terms of plus minus between these two teams. And it's a 4-1 differential last night for the Orioles. This doesn't appear to be something that the Jays necessarily have the personnel to fix, but how do they try to, you know, like the writing is on the wall at this point, they're not going to hit enough home runs as currently constructed. How do you cobble together games against a team that is as powerful as the Baltimore Orioles?
So it, on the offensive side, yes, it does not appear as if the Jays are going to become a big home run hitting team this year. I mean, unless Vladdy and Bo start going off and hitting a ton of homers, because there just aren't that many other guys. You know, Schneider will hit some and Jansen will hit some and Varsho will hit some, obviously. But, you know, Gunnar Henderson has 19, and he's got more. I believe he's got more or as many. I think he's got as many as Guerrero, Bichette, Springer, and Turner combined this year. I know he's hit more home runs in the first inning this year than the Blue Jays have hit as a team this year. So, yeah, they've got four or five real boppers, guys who can hit. They kind of look like the Blue Jays of 2021 right now, to be honest with you, which I know I'm not the first guy to say that. But if there's such a home run disparity, the only way to make up for that is to string hits together and hit with runners in scoring position at a very high clip. And the first thing, stringing hits together, is really, really hard in baseball right now. And the second thing, you know, doing very well with runners in scoring position is not something the Blue Jays have done very well this year. So it's hard. Like, you really have to squint to see it. And it can happen. Listen, maybe Vladdy goes on a tear. Maybe Bo goes on a tear. We don't know. Maybe somebody comes up from AAA and hits a bunch of home runs. We have no idea. Things can turn quickly in baseball, and it is a long, long, long season. But the Orioles right now, like the Blue Jays of 2021 and to a certain extent 2022, they punish you for your mistakes. Like, they don't hit singles. They hit homers when you make mistakes. And like you said, they've got 88. The Blue Jays have hit 51. That's a huge difference at this point of the season.
And again, the Orioles are one of the best teams at suppressing home runs as well. Their staff does a good job keeping the ball in the park. So, you know, some of that is how their park is designed, but they managed to hit them out at their own park. And yeah, you mentioned runners in scoring position is one of the ways that you can cobble it together without the home runs. The Jays are 26th in weighted runs created plus with runners in scoring position, and you know, somewhere in the low 20s with batting average with runners in scoring position. So not getting it done on that side as well. Dan, you mentioned that first inning stat, that Gunnar Henderson has more home runs in the first inning than the Blue Jays have. The Blue Jays have only hit four home runs in the first inning so far this year. The White Sox and the Nationals are the only teams with fewer. We are now at 25 games without a run in the first inning. This is a franchise record. It is two games off of moving into the top five all time, dating back to 1901. Look, some of this is just, well, they're not a very good offensive team. And if you're not a very good offensive team, you will cluster luck and sequence luck your way to some bad streaks, like the cleanup hitter drought that we talked about, like the no more than five runs in a game drought that we talked about. But this one is a little more material, I think, in terms of the stress that Jays starters have to pitch under, the fact that they're playing from underneath a lot of times. 562 OPS in the first inning. Do you have a good explanation for why this has been the case, other than, you know, everyone just individually seems to be worse in the first inning?
No, and I know it's on their radar. I mean, yeah. John Schneider's brought it up, and he's used terms like well-documented, and like it's in the room, obviously. So I don't know why it's happening. They appear not to know why it's happening. Otherwise, you would change it. I don't know what it could be. I mean, obviously, they're getting prepared, and they're there early, and they're, you know, so who knows? And the weird thing is, and you, I don't know if you know this or not, in the second inning, This is just as crazy.
They're first.
In the second inning, they're the highest scoring team in baseball. So in the first inning, they haven't scored in 25 games, and they've only scored 19 runs all year. And in the second inning, they've scored 42 runs, and they're the highest scoring team in baseball. So it is a little bit of, boy, that's not great, but it is quirky. But also, it's just kind of not great, too, the 19 runs thing. Because, like you said, there's a lot of stress on starting pitchers. And, you know, I remember from coaching teenagers and preteens, you know, if you're the road team, you put one or two on the board in the first inning, I mean, your dugout is alive. Like, it matters, you know, a little bit. And I know big leaguers aren't little leaguers, but I think it matters. And it 25 games in a row, and really not even close a lot of times. I mean, and Schneider talked about one game. It must have been Davis Schneider led off with a double, and Jansen hit one to the wall, and then Vladdy smoked one to third, and they made a play. And that's all true, but there haven't been that many innings like that. There have been a lot of 1-2-3s or a lot of leadoff base hit or leadoff double, you know, pop-up strikeout fly ball, and it's over. So I don't know what they can do to change it. And it's just, it may be more a symptom of the larger problem, like you were talking about, the cleanup hitter thing, the five runs thing. These are all symptoms of the larger problem, which is this just hasn't been a very good offensive team this year.
Yeah, and with a couple of the guys, you know, I could understand it, right? You know, Bo Bichette and George Springer rank second and third in Major League Baseball in how much of a boost they get seeing a pitcher a second time. And some of that is random, but some of that I would understand. Okay, you know, Bo Bichette's particular style and approach, he's pretty aggressive. Once he's seen a guy, he can lock in a little bit more. You know, George Springer tends to work a longer at bat. Maybe once he's seen a certain number of pitches, he can identify when to lay off a fastball, get something off speed, whatever. I would get that. But it being the case for everyone on the team and the second inning thing that you just mentioned, like George, it's George Springer is not hitting better because he moved down in the order, but I do think it highlights how kind of frustrating this first inning thing can be, that they finally did the thing everyone was asking for and moved George Springer down in the order, and now he's getting hits in the second inning for them when he couldn't in the first, and that seems to kind of be a team-wide thing. Dan?
Well, and Bo's not hitting it. Bo generally is now hitting in the second inning as well.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, Bo's not sometimes hitting in the first inning, but he hit fifth last night. He's hitting cleanup sometimes. But, you know, now your top three is Schneider, Jansen, Vladdy. And before it was Springer, Bo, Vladdy. So they've in effect, changed two-thirds of the plate appearances that come up in the first inning, give or take, depending on how long the inning goes, and the results are the same. And you know what it's like, you know, and I know you know this, it's like runners in scoring position. You can hit 200 for a month, and then you can hit 300 for a month. And just because somebody says you aren't doing something doesn't mean they're saying you can't do something or you won't do something. We're just saying they aren't doing it. Why? Who knows? But boy, it would make life easier on them if they could get an early lead every now and again.
Yeah, we did exactly what you're saying with runners in scoring position last year. I think in early August, they were dead last in the league. They were on pace to have the worst OPS with runners in scoring position in the history of any playoff team. And then they ended up exactly in the middle of the league by the end of the season. They were 15th in hitting with runners in scoring position. So it can get there. It's frustrating in the interim. Davis Schneider, Dan, has been very good overall, obviously. He has struggled a little bit in the first inning. Certainly not putting this on him. It's a new role. There's some randomness there and small sample size. But I do wonder, and I know you were aware of this stat yesterday, Grayson Rodriguez had thrown a first pitch fastball in every single one of his career major league starts, and Davis got one right over the heart of the plate to start that game. Again, not to put it on Davis, I wonder if you talk to him about that, because I know you do talk to him about hitting a lot. But also, it just kind of stood out to me as like, that seems a little on the nose for this team being, you know, so stick to the swing decision, stick to the plan early in games.
Yeah, and I mean, also, and you know, you and I have never stood in the batter's box of a major league game. He's never seen Grayson Rodriguez before, I don't believe. So, and maybe you just want to see the ball come out of the hand once. And to me, if that's how you feel, that's how you feel. And maybe he didn't know he wanted to take a pitch until, you know, Rodriguez was into his windup, and he said, you know what, I want to see one here. So I don't know. I mean, it doesn't change the trajectory of the game, in my opinion. Like, even if he hits one out, it's great. The streak is over. They get a run. But, you know, overall, Rodriguez was very good, and then the Orioles got to Gausman, and there was a lot of hard contact. So, sure, I would have loved to have seen him swing at it because it was 94, not 97, and it was kind of down in the zone, not up in the zone. So it kind of seemed like it was a good pitch for him to swing at. But, you know, again, until you walk a mile in a man's shoes, right? So who knows what his priorities were as he was getting into the box. And, you know, the other thing about him, and I think he's doing a great job. I mean, he's got an OPS over 800, and he's been one of the best things about this team. But I'd almost love to see him hitting fourth and drive and having more, theoretically, having more guys on base in front of him for him to drive in. His hits are very productive. There are a lot of extra base hits. He's done very well with men on base. I'd love to see him hitting cleanup or something like that, but they don't have another guy to put up in the top spot right now. That's the problem. Like, they keep shuffling the deck here, but they just don't have enough guys who are doing a good job in the important spots to make it work consistently. So they keep trying new things. Like last night, it was Vogelbach cleanup, Bo down to fifth. They've dropped Varsho down. And I'm not sure we're going to see Varsho back up in the two spot again when Jansen is out of the lineup. If you look at Dalton's numbers, they're much, much better down in the lineup than they are up in the lineup. Coincidence? Who knows? But, you know, to say that they're not trying things, and I still see that stuff on Twitter every now and again, to say they're not trying things is crazy. They're not all working. That's the problem. But they are definitely at the point where they're willing to try about anything right now, at least with this roster. The next step, obviously, is you make a couple of moves, and whether it's external or bring guys up from the minors. But within the framework of this roster, they've tried just about everything you can try.
And it's a great point about Davis Schneider being better suited for a run production spot in the order. Unfortunately, like you said, Vlad is the only guy with a higher OBP than him. And, you know, you could actually, given what Vlad's done from a power perspective, you could make a pretty decent case for Vlad to lead off and then go kind of Jansen, Schneider in some order like that. But like you said, there, you know, it's going to come down to guys getting hits in the first inning. I didn't mean that to pick on Davis. I just I know that Mike Petriello broke that stat down on Blue Jays Central before the game. So I was focused in on that that first pitch there. Dan, on the other side, Kevin Gausman had a rough one last night. He had a 2.80 ERA over his 8 starts prior coming into that one, but it had been a little up and down. Didn't get a lot of strikeouts one game, you know, got some against the Tigers, but said his stuff didn't feel very good. Last night after the game, he actually said he thought his stuff was really good. He made the 2 mistakes to Austin Hayes. Anthony Santander golfed one out of the dirt, basically, for a home run. What did you make of Gausman's night and his evaluation afterward that, hey, thought I had good stuff, this is a really good offense?
Right. So stuff and velocity aren't the same thing.
Right.
But his velocity was fine last night. In fact, it was above his season average, which is almost a little bit misleading because he had a couple that were noticeably down at the beginning of the year. So his season average is actually not where, you know, fully healthy 100% out of the chute all season Kevin Gausman is going to be. But I thought he was fine. But they punish you for mistakes. Like, the ball Santander hit out was up and away about 2 inches above the belt and right on the outside corner, maybe even a little wider than that. That's not a pitch that a lot of guys pull and hit out for a home run. So I think there is something to what Gausman is saying. I thought his stuff was pretty good, but the Orioles are on a tear right now, and they're really, really good. I bet you there were a lot of pitchers in 2021 who said, you know, I thought my stuff was pretty good tonight, and the Blue Jays got 7 runs against them because you had a deep, talented, confident lineup. I don't think, and you can't, this is, you can't put a number on this, and I know this is an analytically driven show, but when everybody is struggling or when the team is struggling, I got to believe everybody's trying to do more. Whereas on those 2021 and 2022 Blue Jays, if Laddie didn't get a hit, well, Bo thought he would, or Springer thought he would, or Teoscar thought he would, or Lourdes thought he would, or never mind Marcus Semien back in 2021, right? Like, I think there's a difference between coming to the plate relaxed and knowing the guy behind you is really, really good, or coming to the plate thinking, man, I got to get a hit. My team needs a hit so bad, I got to get a hit. And I believe that can impact success. And I think the Orioles are experiencing it positively right now, like the Blue Jays did 2 and 3 years ago. So the one difference I see in Gausman, and you can look at the numbers and it's there, he's getting to 2 strikes a lot, but he is not putting guys away with 2 strikes as easily as he has in the past. I mean, there have been times in the past where you may as well drop your bat and go back to the dugout at 2 strikes when you're facing Kevin Gausman because it's over. And whether there's not, I don't know as much about horizontal and vertical movement. I know you know a ton more about that than I do. Whether the splitter's not moving quite as much or he's just missing on location on 2 strike pitches. Again, he's getting there a lot, but he's not finishing guys off as easily. I don't know how many were in 2 strike counts last night. I didn't go back and look at that. But I think that's kind of a more general thing for Gausman this year. Last night, I think there's something to what he's saying. I just think the Orioles are on a real heater right now.
Yeah, they certainly are. And yeah, you're right. The second Hayes one was a first pitch, but the others, you know, guys had worked 5-6 pitch at bats to get those ones. And yeah, I don't know why I had in my head that Santander golfed one. It was the reach out up and over the zone. Either way. And yeah, look, Dan, it is an analytically inclined show, but one of the most fascinating things is like, you know, hey, here's what we expect and here's what actually happened. And then we're trying to figure out that gap in between and you know, bring, hey, if you're underperforming expectations, how do you get back there? If you're overperforming, how do you keep riding that? Okay. So Jay's on the mound tonight. They're going to face Corbin Burns on the other side. We don't officially know who their starting pitcher is going to be. This is the Alek Manoah slot. Alek Manoah is on the IL, headed for a second opinion later this week. I know Bowden Francis was around the room last night and in the dugout. Presumably one of Little or Burr get optioned down today, though they were the only guys used out of the bullpen yesterday. That's the one, I guess, silver lining from that game. And then you've got some combination of Bowden Francis, Trevor Richards, Yenesis Cabrera, and everyone else available. Is that kind of your read on how tonight will go in whatever order?
Yeah, I'm guessing there's an opener. Otherwise, I think John Schneider just would have said, we're going to activate Bowden Francis and he's going to start. But if that's not the case, you know, Schneider did say, well, tonight's game could impact the plans tomorrow. I mean, unless something's wrong with Bowden Francis, and I don't think there is. I mean, Schneider said last night he's checked all the boxes. I'm assuming he'll be active and he'll pitch, you know, 3-4 innings tonight. But I'm guessing they go with an opener. And if you look at the Baltimore lineup the way it was constructed last night, you got a lefty in Henderson first, a switch hitter Rutschman second, then you got Mountcastle, and then you go back to lefty and switch hitter, I believe. I'm trying to remember who it is. O'Hearn and Santander. So four of the first five batters are left-handed batters, including the switch hitters, if there's a righty on the mound. And that's got Trevor Richards written all over it to me. Mm-hmm. Lefties are hitting 111 off him this year, 4-36. So I would guess Richards opens and then Francis comes in. Like if it's a lineup like the 2021 Blue Jays or 2022 Blue Jays, as good as they were with 4, 5, 6 righties at the top, that's where if you had a Zach Pop or a Nate Pearson, you throw them out there. But to me, Richards seems like the better fit against the kind of lineup that Baltimore has. But I have no inside knowledge. This is just me, you know, having nothing better to think about on my drive home last night. So this is what I do. So my guess would be Richards and then Francis, and then hopefully you got a lead and you got your high leverage guys ready to go.
And Santander and Rutschman, the two switch hitters, it should be said, are hitting worse against righties this year than lefties. So you get the benefit of turning them to their lesser side. And Trevor Richards has a bit of that kind of platoon neutrality, I guess. And then what that sets you up to do, you know, this is, I'm not a huge, I don't love the opener in general, but if this works and say Trevor Richards gets you through the first five or even six batters, what that lets you do is if you only trust Bowden Francis for once through the order, well, when he gets to the second time through the order, he's facing the bottom of the order instead of the top of the order that he would be. So maybe you can get an extra inning out of a Bowden Francis there. Dan, do you, this is maybe a tough question to answer until we see how tonight goes, but if Alek Manoah is out more medium to long term, they probably can't do this approach every fifth time through in this, like they got 36 games in 38 days here. That's probably a little much, right?
I think so. I mean, you have to try to keep stretching out Bowden Francis. So if he's at 60 pitches now, can you get him up to 75 to 85? It's not just can you physically stretch him out. He's a big, strong guy. It's will his stuff hold? You know, can he go 2.5 times through an order instead of 1.5 and his stuff holds so that he can be effective? I don't know how many other options they have. The other name to consider, of course, is Yariel Rodriguez. Mm-hmm. So who's probably so he's pitching tomorrow night. I don't know if he needs more after that. But you could almost make the two of them a combo platter, like a piggyback, which you don't often see. You see openers and bulk guys. You don't really see piggyback situations in the majors that much. But maybe that's the way to do it. And then you can have Trevor Richards, who's the Swiss Army knife of the bullpen, right? Wherever you need him, and you use him. And generally, he does a great job. So, but if you do that, if Francis and Rodriguez are in effect one guy, then you're down a guy in the bullpen. Now, other teams deal with this. The Blue Jays have actually had to deal with this a lot less over the last couple of years than most teams because of the, you know, they've spent their money on the rotation, and generally it's paid off really well. They got some really good guys there. But I would think if I would think Francis is, you know, choice number one, and Rodriguez is 1A. And if you have to combo them, you have to combo them. But there aren't a lot of other great options within the organization that I'm aware of right now. And at this point, I don't think you're going out and trading for a starting pitcher. It's early. They're not in a position to do that. The standings at this point don't dictate that they should do that, in my opinion. So I think you got to try to figure it out with Francis and Rodriguez and hope that works.
Yeah, it's tough. There are maybe some guys out there, Jeff Passan reporting today that the White Sox would move Garrett Crochet, but that's probably going to cost you a lot asset-wise. You know, the Angels just optioned Reed Detmers. What does that look like? But, you know, like you said, they're probably not in a position to be buying if you don't know for sure that you won't be selling, for right. lack of a better way to put it. Dan, before I let you go here, I've kept you a little long, but quickly, Vlad at third base, thumbs up on this experience or thumbs down?
Yeah, I mean, two plays, he made them both, and one was a difficult play. So, you know, the reasoning behind it that we were told is if they wanted to get Vlad and Turner and Vogelback all into the lineup at the same time. If they think there's a matchup that suggests those three should all be in the lineup at the same time. The only way that makes sense is if Vogelback and Turner are swinging the bats pretty well. Vogelback was until last night. Turner hasn't in a while. When you do that, you are weakening your defense at first base because Vlad's better than Turner there. You're weakening it at third base because IKF probably is better than Vlad. And then because IKF goes over to second, Schneider's at left and Kiermaier's out of the lineup. So you're weakening it in the outfield as well because Schneider and Varsho is not as good as Varsho and Kiermaier. So you're weakening your defense at three spots to do this. That's a lot. And I don't think this is an everyday thing. And John Schneider certainly made it clear it's not an everyday thing. You know, if Turner doesn't start hitting more, they could just platoon Vogelback and Turner. Mm-hmm. Right. Make it really simple. Righty starts, Vogelback starts, and a lefty comes in from the pen, Turner pinch hits. And a lefty starts, Turner starts, and a righty comes in from the pen, and maybe Vogelback pinch hits, or maybe Turner stays. You know, down the road, and I know you've thought this, I don't know if you've talked about it on your show, is a secondary consideration of this, well, hey, if Spencer Horwitz comes up at some point, then it would be nice to know if Vladdy can handle third. And I think there's some validity to that. I am in the Spencer Horwitz camp. I think he could help. Not be a savior, but I think he could help. But, you know, the way the roster is constructed right now, they have decided it's not a move they want to make right now. So whether that changes in the future, I don't know. If they're out of it and they're sellers, it certainly is going to change, obviously. And you're going to bring guys up from Buffalo for the last couple of months. But I'd like to see Vladdy play third. Yes, it gives them more flexibility. I think it comes at a cost and defensively in other places, as we've talked about. But I think it's worth knowing if he can do that as much maybe for Horwitz down the road as it is for anything going on right now.
Yeah, and it certainly looks a lot more justifiable if Turner and Vogelbach start OPSing higher than 640. And right. You're right. And
that's the biggest part. Yeah, that's the biggest part of the whole thing is that the more those guys hit, the more you want to get them both in the lineup. So, yeah, sorry to interrupt.
No, that's okay. Horwitz, by the way, has now played 9 full games at second base. Told me last week it's going pretty well in his estimation. So we'll see. Dan Schulman, thanks so much for taking the time out this morning.
All right, Blake. Talk to you again soon.
Dan Schulman, voice of the Toronto Blue Jays on Sportsnet. We got a fun, full show. We're going to talk to Shai Davidi a little later as well. He's been on top of this series and the series on the weekend. A lot of great stuff from him. We'll talk to Jeff Arnold, play-by-play voice of the Orioles at Masson. And then we're going to talk to Jake Mintz of Yahoo Sports and the Baseball Barbercast coming up here in a little bit. One MLB announcement note. This came down during the show. MLB, and this was first reported by our pal Lindsay Adler of the Wall Street Journal last night, and MLB has made it official today. 5 players have been suspended for violations relating to MLB's sports betting policy. You can go read the details in MLB's press release. It's pretty bleak because the amounts aren't very high, and like the guys all did a really poor job of, you know, it's like one guy got suspended for an entire year for betting like $100 on MLB parlays, but you can't do this stuff at all. So Michael Kelly from the A's system, Jay Groom from the Padres system, Jose Rodriguez from the Phillies system, Andrew Saulfrank from the D-backs system, and then Tucapita Marcano from the Padres. So those first 4 guys are suspended for a year. Marcano has been deemed permanently ineligible. So he's getting the Jonte Porter treatment here. He's done. So that's a sad one to see. You can go read more details on that obviously a larger discussion about where we are with this in general. You know, one of the best stories in the minor leagues right now is David Fletcher trying to reinvent himself as a, if you remember him as like a utility infielder, he's now a knuckleball pitcher in the minors. But he's also part of a big gambling investigation into that Shohei Ippe investigation. So unfortunate to see these things, but you can keep an eye on that for news. I'm sure Blair and Barker will be talking about it on their show a little later as well, maybe even have Jeff Passan on. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Jake Mintz of Cespedes Family Barbecue joins us as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Hey, it's Ailish Forafar.
And I'm Justin Cuthbert.
Join us as we discuss the most important sports stories of the day and tee up the biggest games of the night.
It's the Fan Pregame, 6 p.m. weekdays on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays lose last night 7-2. Fun baseball weekend that we can still look back on a little bit. The City Connect debut, the start of the NCAA tournament. Fun night around baseball last night. If you're not a Blue Jays fan, there was a really cool Rhys Hoskins kind of return game against the Phillies. Hit a homer, had a fun play at the plate with JT Realmuto. Let's go through all of it with Jake Mintz of Yahoo Sports, co-host of the Baseball Barbie Cast at Yahoo with Jordan Schusterman. Jake, what's up, man? First time talking to you. Longtime fan. Thanks for doing this.
Pleasure to be here. Excited to hop around the league.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's hop around a different league very briefly first. You're a big college baseball guy. How'd you enjoy that first weekend of the NCAA tournament?
There is nothing more chaotic and more beautiful than the first weekend of D1 regionals because you have, right, there are 64 teams playing in 16 four-team regionals across the country, and they're all happening at the exact same time, overlapping with one another. And so it's just total beautiful chaos. It's over 100 games over the weekend, and I was just parked in front of my TV for the entire time. We've got 16 teams left in the D1 baseball postseason. They'll play super regionals this weekend, and then we'll have 8 teams in Omaha about a week from now. And I will be headed to Nebraska to watch it all, and I'm very excited.
Man, any excuse to go to Nebraska, but especially one for the Super 8. No, that does sound like a lot of fun.
My beautiful fiance is going to Columbia, to Cartagena on a work trip at the exact same time that I will be going to Omaha, Nebraska on a work trip. And I think we're going to have a slightly different experience.
Yeah, yours is going to be terrific, filled with baseball. Hers is probably, I mean, who knows, maybe also have some baseball. Yeah, that's a difference in environment. For sure. Jake, okay, let's switch back to MLB here. We'll look forward to your stuff out of the Super 8 in Nebraska there. Look, you whip around the MLB regular. I know you've got your eyes on everything. I know you guys on the pod talked about the Jays debuting their City Connect jersey. Before we talk aesthetics, though, what is your read on this Blue Jays team from afar? I always like to get a national perspective because we're in it day-to-day, and it's heavy and it's frustrating. What is your read on this team?
It's so weird. They're so weird because for the last couple of seasons, the pitching was the core of this team. It was the base of it. It was the foundation, and the bottom has just kind of fallen out. And I think last night's game against Baltimore was just a great example of this. Kevin Gausman does not look right. And that's a bummer because when he's on, he's one of the best pitchers in baseball. His four-seam fastball has been pulverized this year. I mean, the expected batting average on that thing is like 340, right? And when he's not right and the pitching staff's not right, nothing feels like it's going to go well. And I'm sure you've seen that on a day-to-day basis. Good to see Vlad picking it up. Now, I know there was some discourse last week about, okay, what do the Jays do, right? Like, do they bail? Do they pull the plug? Do they trade some of these guys at the deadline? And I don't really think that they can, at least not yet. And at least not now. They have the core of a team that can compete for a playoff spot, particularly now that the playoffs are a little bit bigger with the expanded wildcard team. But I think what is most frustrating to Blue Jays fans, and I sympathize with this, they do not look like a team right now on June 4th. They do not look like a team that can win the World Series. And that is the expectation and should be the expectation for a team that looked like they could win the World Series 2 years ago. And so I really do understand the frustration that has been bubbling up among Jays fans.
And it's not a one-year thing, right? Like 2020, the expanded playoff field, they made it. They were all young. You know, everyone's got years of control. Hey, sign Hyunjin Ryu and George Springer to be the first wave of this. And then 2021, the expectations are a little higher. They come up one game short. 2022, it's like, okay, we made it, got swept, learning lesson. Last year, okay, we made it, got swept, and now we're back here again. So it's never really gotten out of first gear. So that, you know, it's kind of been a snowball of that frustration for this fan base, I think, because they were supposed to have taken several steps by now.
Yeah, and what I think what else is frustrating is the second level of offensive talent hasn't materialized sufficiently. And it's weird because if you look at it and you're like, wow, Davis Schneider, what a win. Danny Jansen is a very good offensive catcher. And yet it just, the results haven't really been there consistently from a lot of the other second level players. And that's been a consistent theme, right, throughout the last few years for Toronto. And like the organization spending all that money on George Springer is a good thing and has generally been a good thing. The decline phase of any free agent is just part of the process. That's baked into the math, and you have to accept that. However, I think any criticism about the front office's unwillingness to spend, like bringing back even a guy like Matt Chapman, right? Not wanting to really go all in on this current window, that's disappointing, right? And for fans who invest their money and their time and their love into a thing to now see what has been a very slow decline back into being a bad club, like that's scary and a total bummer. I wish I had more optimism for you, but I don't. I just do not.
No, it's going to be a tough road back. And okay, well, at least did you think they looked good on Friday and Monday? Do you like their City Connect all right?
Oh, yeah. I think they're solid. I mean, here are my thoughts on the Blue Jays City Connect. They are the unfortunate recipient of like all of the black or navy jerseys that we've had. So if these come out 2 years ago, I think I'm much more excited about them. But most of the City Connects that we've had this season have just looked black tops, black pants. And so they do kind of run together in my mind as someone who sees 28 of these things over the course of the year. However, what is important about a City Connect jersey? That the people in the town like it. So my opinion doesn't matter one iota compared to what people in the city think. One last thing on the Blue Jays, like their Fangraphs odds for the playoffs right now, I think they're around like 15 to 20%. The American League has been soft enough that, you know, two hot weeks and it does feel like they can get their way back into the mix. I mean, despite all the negativity, we sit here on June 4th and they're how many games out?
Five.
They're five games back. And five games feels like a lot, but there's 4 months of the season left, right? They could easily be five games better over the remainder of the season than the Minnesota Twins, who are holding that last wild card spot. And so while pessimism is understandable, let's wait another month before we really start pulling our hair out.
Well, and that's what the front office is doing, you know, when it comes to this idea of, well, if they're not in it, they should probably at least look to retool for 2025, sell off some of these free agents. They'd have some interesting guys, but this front office is not going to move on that until mid-July. Like, we're probably coming out of the All-Star break before they consider that strongly.
The thing that you need to remember about retooling or rebuilding, any type of retooling specifically for the Blue Jays doesn't make sense. There's no quick rebuild here, right? No. They don't have those types of pieces at a specific age and a specific level of team control where that makes sense. A good version of the Toronto Blue Jays in the next 3 years, 2 to 3 years, involves Vlad Guerrero and Bo Bichette, right? And so why would a front office trade those guys away? If this front office trades those guys away and they admit defeat on this particular window, there is a likelihood that this front office is not around to see the next good window, right? And so it's important to remember what motivations the people making the decisions have, whether or not it's the best decision for the Blue Jays to pull the plug. I personally don't think it is, but if I'm running this team, there's no way that I would do that. I mean, you look in San Diego, right? AJ Preller, their general manager, is someone who is very incentivized to go for it because he's on the hot seat. I don't think the Blue Jays are necessarily at that same level, but it's just a dynamic to keep in mind.
Yeah, and it's something I think the conversation would quickly turn more to a couple guys who are pending free agents, a Kikuchi, a Jimmy Garcia, maybe even a Danny Jansen. Ross Atkins went on MLB Network Radio on Sunday, basically because of those Vlad Bo rumors that had been out there, and was like, it doesn't make any sense for us. It's they've got control left, they're young, we'd be selling low. It just doesn't make any sense. Okay. Let's pivot off the Blue Jays here a little bit, Jake, whip around. I wanted to talk Orioles, but there's something else I want to make sure we get to, and it is, what is Tommy Pham's problem? Do you have an idea?
So Tommy Pham is what he is. And I think that there is a place and a space for somebody like Tommy Pham in a big league clubhouse. And I think, you know, based upon conversations I've had with people, people respect his intensity. It's not a bit, right? It's not a shtick. It's not an act. That is who that man is. His background and his life has created a person who is understandably volatile and scratchy and will stand up for the things he believes in. Even if in this particular instance, right, with William Contreras, I think Pham was in the wrong and he was a little bit too sensitive in that spot. You know exactly what you're getting with Tommy Pham as a person. And there is a reason that he was traded for at the deadline last year, right, by the Diamondbacks, who ended up going to the World Series. There's a reason he's going to have the same exact thing happen to him this year. He's on the White Sox. The White Sox suck. He's been fine. Some team is going to trade for him. He's going to be their bench outfielder and pinch hitter, and he's going to bring a very refreshing intensity to the proceedings.
Yeah, and look, he trained all offseason, so if there's a bench clear and brawl at any point, he's ready to go. He can commissioner your team fantasy football league. He's ready to go. Okay, wanted to ask you about a couple things you wrote recently. You did this great piece on Jamai Jones, the invisible Yankee, and I know it was a couple weeks ago now, but wanted to revisit it. Man, you get into digging on that. How cool was that? And how, I mean, it feels like everything's kind of been done in baseball at this point, but it really did feel like you and the Jamai Jones story are something we haven't seen in a while.
So, yeah, let's talk about Jamai Jones. When I wrote the story about 2 weeks ago, the conceit was Jamai Jones has been on the Yankees roster since opening day. He has started 2 games. He has had 10 plate appearances. He has barely played, and that is because the Yankees core infield group has been remarkably healthy, and thus they have not needed Jamai Jones to start any games. He is frankly has not proven in his career that he is good enough to be starting for the New York Yankees, and I think he understands that, and that was kind of what was in the article. But the reason I wrote the article at the time I did is that DJ LeMahieu was coming back from injury. And I thought that LeMahieu's return would almost surely mean Jones would be sent down after 2 months of being on the Yankees roster and barely playing. And then 2 days before LeMahieu's return, John Birdie goes down with an injury. And it was like God was watching out for Jamai Jones, because Jamai Jones is still on the Yankees roster and has not played. He's not had a plate appearance since I wrote the article. Right. And it is an amazing life that he is living. He is needling this balance, right, between believing in himself as an everyday big leaguer and accepting the reality of a situation where he's there to supplement and pinch run and be a defensive replacement and to cheer his buddies and hang out. And it's just a very fascinating life. Would I want that life? 100,000%, yes. Because he's made like $300,000 for watching the Yankees this year. Now, granted, yes, he's working very hard. I understand that. I like Jamai Jones, good guy. He's putting the work in. He deserves to be there. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that there are worse gigs in American society than Jamai Jones.
Yeah, this is, you know, sports talk, right? Or talk with your friends. It gets kicked around. What job would you most, like, what role would you most want? And like 15th man in the NBA comes up, like you're the victory cigar at the end or whatever. And I've always said third catcher, like a team's carrying a third catcher, maybe once a week, you got to go back there as a late inning replacement or something like that. Jamai Jones might have topped it. Here's something for you to watch. So he obviously hasn't played in that many games, so this isn't going to be particularly relevant. But Bradley Zimmer, a couple years ago for the Blue Jays, became just the 7th player in league history to appear in 100 games but have fewer than 100 plate appearances. I feel like we can create here over the course of the season like a Jamai Jones all-star of different ways to stick around and not play ever.
I mean, Jamai Jones, right, he's at 13 games and 10 plate appearances.
Yeah.
We had something somewhat similar to this last year. Charlie Culberson was on the Braves roster for 2 separate 1-month stints and tallied 1 plate appearance because the Braves never got hurt. And the difference, though, is that Culberson at the time was like at the downslope of his career. He was a well-liked veteran at the end. Jamai Jones is 26. Like, this is a guy who could be a legitimate second division level starter somewhere, maybe, right? Or at least he still thinks that's the case. And so it's a very fascinating dynamic to watch him go through his work every day with the Yankees.
Yeah, he's a former top 100 prospect by some of the ranking systems. So this is it's one of those, and this is probably why he's still on the roster, is like, well, wouldn't you get someone with some other utility? No, he'd probably get claimed. Someone would use Jamai Jones.
Now, there's two other things. One, would he get claimed? Maybe. He has hardly seen live pitching in the last 2.5 months. He's basically like an injured guy in that regard, right? He hasn't seen pitching besides his 10 plate appearances. And whenever there's a rehabbing Yankee throwing, usually they come in and he'll face them. And then the other thing to remember is people like Jamai Jones are not like, it's very hard to be a bad dude,
right?
And have Jamai Jones's job. And to exist and survive on the back of a big league roster, you have to be affable. You have to be flexible. You have to be interactive. You have to be well-liked, because think about it like this. If Aaron Judge thought Jamai Jones was a jerk, Aaron Judge would go to the GM and say, we could find someone else who could have 10 plate appearances, right? These dudes really like Jamai, and Jamai puts the work in, and I'm a big fan. It's a fascinating dynamic. Great story.
All right. One other thing you wrote about this week, and we've only got about 3 minutes left here, but the Jorge Lopez situation. So for anyone who missed it, throws his glove in frustration, talks after the game, tries to do the interview in English. It maybe gets misinterpreted or bad faith presented. You wrote a really empathetic piece about Jorge Lopez, what he's gone through, and you know, talking to a lot of people around baseball that, hey, this is a guy who is a much better guy and teammate than this is being made out to. What can you tell us about Lopez and your reporting from that piece?
Yeah, I mean, just, and I knew this about Lopez before this whole thing happened, is he was someone who, when he was in Baltimore, was incredibly well-liked by his teammates and by the organization as a whole, to the point that Baltimore brought him back after he had an unsuccessful stint with the Twins and the Marlins in 2023. And so when this whole thing happened and I saw him kind of being villainized, it didn't really mesh with me. Lopez has a history of having some mental health issues. He took a mental health IL stint last year when he was with the Twins for 15 days. And when I watched the video of him explaining what happened, that did not look like a person who was okay, right?
Yeah.
And it was an uncomfortable watch. Whether or not he was mistranslated or misinterpreted, I mean, I believe that he did not mean to say we're the worst team in the league. Whether or not I believe that he confirmed that he said that, but I believe that was missed in communication at some point. Like, that was not a person who should have been answering for his own decisions. Now, I think that he does need to answer for his conduct on the field. It was embarrassing. And that, you know, his lack of English proficiency or his mental health issues doesn't excuse the way he conducted himself. However, I think that his response in the locker room just deserves a bit of grace and a bit of empathy and a bit of understanding that this is a human being going through a bad day at work and was struggling with a language barrier. And that's something that I think we should all be pretty empathetic to.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's really well said. And the piece was really well written. We do have one extra minute, so I'm going to throw one more thing at you. Reese Hoskins revenge game homer. I know he's a favorite of the pod. How much fun was that one for you guys last night?
Oh, it was so cool. I wish I had made the drive down from New York to go see it. I mean, Reese Hoskins in Philadelphia was genuinely beloved. And part of that is he was on the Phillies for 4 years before they got good. And so for a lot of Phillies fans, Reese Hoskins was the light in the darkness. He was the reason to care about something. And he did not return to the Phillies because the roster construction didn't make sense. Bryce Harper is now playing first base. Everyone knew Reese Hoskins was going to leave. And for him to come back and have such, you know, an emotional return, you could see it. I mean, you see all these videos, like, he was loving every moment of it. And then for him to go deep off of Zach Wheeler was so confusing for Phillies fans. There are clips of them clapping and booing at the same time, which is just perfect. So, yeah, shouts out to Reese, one of the best guys in all of baseball. I'm glad he got that moment.
Yeah, and let's run this back in the playoffs. Brewers and Phillies both atop their divisions. Jake Mintz of Yahoo Sports, of the Barbie cast, thanks so much for taking the time, man.
A pleasure. I guarantee you, if Hoskins is there in October, he will indeed get booed.
Yeah, those Phillies fans aren't going to mess around. Thanks, Jake. Jake Mintz of Yahoo Sports, of the Baseball Barbie cast, with Jordan Schusterman over there. All around good dude. Yeah, Reese Hoskins, a fun moment. It would be nice if the Blue Jays had one at some time this series. You can text us, by the way. We'll sprinkle some in through the second hour. You text us 590-590. I've gotten a couple on Twitter as well. So if you are those people who have tweeted me, they are in the queue. I just, it's a little easier to Keep track of them all through the text line, 590-590. We're going to talk to Shai Davidi in the second segment here as well. We'll talk to Jeff Arnold from the Orioles side and continue to tee up this series, figure out who Connor Norby is and how the Orioles just keep coming up with these guys. Oh, we have Jackson Holliday and Heston Kjerstad at AAA, but you know what? We're going to go with another second-round pick that we had. All that coming up in the second hour as Jays Talk Plus continues, the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Big guests and bigger opinions on everything happening in Leafsland. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy, making myself laugh with Wagwan Delilah. I don't know what the internet is doing anymore. I don't know what Drake is doing anymore. Anyway, I don't know what the Jays are going to do to try to hit Corbin Burnes a day after they did not hit Grayson Rodriguez. They are trying a lot more stuff from a process perspective. The way they evaluate hitters after games and when they go in to do their cage work the next day, that is something that there's been a bit of a shift in mentality, a bit of a shift in the way they internalize or evaluate those things internally. Shai Davidi wrote a really great piece about it Friday. Let's bring him in to talk about that. But we'll talk about last night first. Shai Davidi of Sportsnet.ca. How are we doing this morning?
I'm all right, Blake. How are you?
I am good. Okay, so I do want to talk about that great piece you wrote Friday, but you're also on this series, and you wrote a piece last night after that game that called it a reality check. You had some great quotes from Isaiah Kiner-Falefa in there about, hey, you know, it's time to pony up. They got to be ready to play every single day. What did you make of that loss last night? Obviously, just one game of this series, but quick whiplash after playing so many against the White Sox and Pirates.
Yeah, it underlined how little margin for error the Blue Jays have against a team like the Orioles. And, you know, it's hard to fault Kevin Gausman for the home run that Anthony Santander hit against him in the, was it second inning there? It's an 0-2 fastball, 96 above the zone. It's the chase swing that you want, and somehow he gets the bat head on it and out it goes. Right. But then, you know, he himself says it's two mistakes to Austin Hayes. One's a splitter, it doesn't do much. The other's a fastball that's middle. And Austin Hayes does what you're supposed to do with those. And that's the quick damage that the Orioles could put on you. And the Blue Jays don't have the offensive firepower to respond in that way. And Grayson Rodriguez has been great since getting back earlier this season. And that's a tough ask. But the, you know, without that instant offense, the way that the Orioles have, the damage that they can do so quickly, the Blue Jays have to be really good. And they played that kind of game really tight defensively from a pitching perspective during the two games that they had in Baltimore around that rainout. And that's what they have. That's the style that they're going to need against the Orioles, because they can't match that team blow for blow.
So yeah, they can't. And John Schneider had that quote to you that, you know, they're built to do damage. They have eight regulars with a slugging percentage over .435. The Jays have three. And there was a 71-point gap between those two teams in terms of slugging percentage. Obviously, home runs aren't everything, but, you know, where the Jays are offensively, it's going to be so tough, Shai, for them to keep up when they're this far behind good teams in the home run battle. There are obviously more ways to score runs than just the home run, but, you know, have the Jays got them themselves in a situation here, you know, personnel-wise and power-wise, where it's going to be an uphill battle against these good teams pretty much no matter what?
Yeah, well, I mean, the way to think about it is that yesterday's lineup, the Blue Jays had 41 home runs total in it, and the Orioles had 44, I believe it was, just from their top four hitters alone.
Right.
Right? So that's a massive gap. And so your pitching has to be on point. And the Jays did a great job with that top four yesterday. They were 3-for-18 with a walk. Like, they contained that part of the lineup. And then it's the bottom five guys who are doing the damage against you. And so the Blue Jays don't have that quite that degree of depth. So they've got to have the lockdown pitching. And then it's waiting for the one or two big blows that you're able to get. And you know, you got the Vladimir Guerrero Jr. home run yesterday. It's his first since May 23rd. And he's been hitting really well for a while. And you know, believe he feels like the power is going to come. He just needs to keep doing the types of things that he's doing, chasing the types of pitches that he's chasing right now, and the results will come. And then they got the triple from Dalton Varsho, and then it dries up from there. And so it's tough to win 3-2, 2-1 all the time, but against the better teams, that's the pathway for the Jays, and it's the reality of who they are right now.
So, you know, last night against Grayson Rodriguez, that's kind of highlighted. And I know Grayson Rodriguez is a very good pitcher. You know, he throws hard. He's got nasty stuff, whether it's you're just looking at it or you're looking at a stuff plus metric. You know, he's top 10 among all starting pitchers in that. John Schneider's estimation, they missed a lot of fastballs or didn't do much with them in the zone. I mean, that approach against Rodriguez, I would have thought, given what we've known about the Blue Jays so far this year, and even back to last year, swing decisions, long plate appearances, et cetera, this Orioles team's one kind of weakness is they have an okay but not great bullpen. Four-game series here, maybe you want to try to get in against it. Were you a little surprised that the Jays kind of weren't on top of Rodriguez a little better if they were going to be aggressive? I thought they were going to go the other way and be like super, super patient to try to get into that bullpen, get him out of there early.
Yeah, I mean, sure. And like, they actually had been generally this season pretty good at grinding out starting pitchers mm-hmm. and making it tough on them. And I don't know, maybe it was a little bit too aggressive at times. There were definitely some quick innings there. And, you know, that's sort of the yin and the yang of being aggressive, right? Sometimes you'll hit balls hard and get into outs. Like Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, for instance, had four hard hit balls. Three of them were right at somebody and it's an out. And then one of them's a single, right? But he did the right thing in the other at bat. They hit a ball hard. It's just a line drive right at the center fielder. So that's sort of the both ends of the stick that you sometimes have to deal with there. And I was a little bit surprised, but then also like, let's give Grayson Rodriguez some credit. I mean, it's a good pitcher. It's tough. It's a hard 96. He's got some breaking balls you have to worry about. It's tough to always, get your best swing off against the guy. And that has been an emphasis for the Blue Jays, trying to find more ways to get your best swing off more often. And obviously it wasn't the case yesterday.
Yeah, so you mentioned that, trying to get your best swing off a little more often. And that's kind of the heart of this piece that you wrote on Friday, how Blue Jays are correcting offense to try to rescue their season. That's up at sportsnet.ca. I do want to go over a little bit with you. So, you know, the narrative part of the story here is there's a new scorecard system that the Jays, you know, you come in the next day to do your work in the cage or off the tee or whatever. Hey, here's how we're evaluating your game yesterday. Now, that's not everything. Obviously, I don't want to overstate it. And hey, that's how they're evaluating over, you know, OPS or home runs or anything like that now. But it's a new way of kind of processing information and processing your at-bats after the fact. And it is a change from the way they were doing these things earlier in the year, which obviously was not working, Shai. So you explained it in the piece, but for anyone who didn't catch that, what can you tell us about this new kind of system that the Jays are operating with here?
Sure. So the Jays have had something like this before, but the piece got started, like, I was having a conversation with Justin Turner, who's former Dodger, obviously, and the Dodgers are known within the game, are considered to be among the teams who do better offensive game planning and have a bit of a reputation for giving their hitters good information and preparing them well. So you said, hey, how similar, different are the things that you're doing? And then, you know, Justin Turner ended up talking a bit about the scorecard system, and this was something that they did with the Dodgers. And it wasn't just based on, hey, you get, like, you have a good swing, that's a point, a bad swing, that's a point. It was more sort of trying to reward other process pieces. So, you know, are all the swings that you took at pitches in the zone that you're supposed to be doing? Like, if you chased, did you chase in an area that is near where you're doing damage? And that's sort of what you're looking for. Was it an aggressive swing? Was it your best swing? Did you take pitches in your zone where you do damage? That's a deduction. You know, then were you able to do something productive, even if you made it out? Were you able to move a runner over? Were you able to foul off a bunch of pitches and extend in a bat? All those things are positively rewarded. And the premise is that you're not just rewarding results and saying, oh, you got a hit, so you did well. It's about, did you have a good total process in your at-bat? Were you able to contribute something even if you didn't get the hit? Because, you know, if you, let's say you, if you have a quick out, it's on two pitches, that's much different than if you see seven or eight pitches against, against a guy and you make an out, right? That's a wearing down of the pitcher that helps the next batter and the next batter after that, and the next batter after that, because you get a pitcher into the 20, 25 pitch range in an inning, he's far more likely to make a mistake than he is on pitch 8 to 15 or whatever. And so those types of little things, elements of within the game, are things they've wanted to reward. But that's a byproduct of sort of larger shifts that have been occurring as the Blue Jays are trying to find ways to get themselves out of the funk that they've been in so far this season.
Yeah, as Justin Turner said to you, you know, it's better to be 0-1 than 0-4-1. So, you know, if you take a strike, if you swing aggressively at something and it's, you know, it's an okay strike, you're better off than, you know, swinging at something you shouldn't be swinging at. You can't do a lot of damage with and putting it out on the board. So, look, it comes across in your piece. You know, this is about the process. This is about reinforcing the good things. There are some notes, too, about, you know, situational hitting. Did you move a runner up? That kind of thing. So it's not all just the swings. But this is, you know, this sounds pretty standard, but it is shy a shift in the mindset a little bit. The quote that was given to you in the piece is taking more intentful swings in times when you can. What does it tell you that the Jays have tried to kind of shift, if not the information itself, the messaging around it as they try to pull themselves out of this?
Well, the way that I might frame it, Blake, is that I think they were trying to, or at least some hitters felt like the Jays were trying to do everything at the plate. You know, you want to cover, you want to be good at contact, you want to hit the ball hard. And I think that at least in some cases, I don't want to speak across the board, that players might have maybe had too much, or had some information overload, and maybe they're thinking, is this a pitch that I should swing at, and being maybe a bit more careful with some of their swings, as opposed to really unleashing and getting their best swing off. And, you know, the one of the phrases I heard a lot was one you mentioned, is just swinging with more intent. Another one that I've heard a fair bit is just players saying they feel a little more freed up in terms of what they're attacking. And it's not so much worrying about, am I swinging at the right pitches, and getting in your head that way, just feeling like, okay, this is what I need to be attacking, and I'm going to go attack that. And just being in an aggressive mindset and not sort of worrying that you're facing a penalty if you do end up chasing a pitch or whatever the case may be. So it is a lot deeper than just sort of like, hey, there's do this and do that. It's about how you're feeling in the box, the type of aggression that you're taking in there. And look, it's not just, hey, go in there, swing, no worries. I think, you know, Justin Turner framed it really well when he said, you know, if you're chasing a pitch that's in your zone, that's near where you do damage, well, that makes sense. But if you hit the ball really well on the inner half of the plate, and you chase something low and away, then what are you doing there? That's when you start getting to a problem. Did you not see the pitch, or are you just over aggressive? And so that's the balance that the Blue Jays are trying to thread. And, you know, we talked a lot. It's kind of funny looking back at some of the conversations around this team in 21 and 22, where it was like, oh, this team is really all or nothing, and there's so much power. It's all about power. They don't do other things, and maybe they need to go the other way at times. And then, you know, the Blue Jays start making that shift last year, and all of a sudden, yes, there are lineup changes. It's a significant part of this. But, you know, now that power isn't there, and you're like, well, what happened to the power? And maybe that's all tied into it.
Yeah, they went from all or nothing to some or nothing, and that's not as good of an upside. Anyway, so since these changes, this has been about a month now. The OPS has been about 50 points higher since the system change here. And look, some of that is just natural regression. Some of that is certainly the quality of competition they've faced since then. And they haven't hit that many home runs, even as things have been better. But to hear Kevin Gausman tell you, Shai, you know, pretty obvious if you've been watching us, there's a change that's been made. Yeah, I mean, I guess just what are you looking for personally, having talked to these people about this, to Turner, to Gausman, to IKF, to, I know you had the conversation for a different piece a couple weeks back with hitting coach Matt Hegg. What are you looking for this next little while when we try to evaluate where this Jays offense is at now that the schedule is kind of turning back to more difficult?
Well, it's, I think there's a few things, right? And one, is the damage still there, right? The Blue Jays were well under a homer a game through that first stretch, dating back to the beginning of the season to that Twin Series in Toronto last month. And then from that Twin Series onwards, I mean, I did the math last week. I haven't calculated since, but they were over a homer a game from that point forward. And that's a big difference, right? That the Blue Jays need that slug. But, you know, as I'm kind of casting forward, I think a bigger question is, and I haven't tracked this yet, and I really want to do a comparison, but how many players on the Blue Jays right now are on track to meet or exceed their preseason projections, right? And I actually think that's more of a structural question that is a bit important, because it feels like, and I don't have the data, so I don't want to say this, but it feels like not very many of them are on track to meet, let alone exceed it, right? I think if you're talking about maybe exceeding, you'd probably look at Davis Schneider, maybe Danny Jansen and Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, and probably Dalton Varsho. And beyond that, I mean, how many guys are on path to meet, even meet their projections? And so if you're having that many players who aren't on that track, well, why is that? And is that evaluative? Is that something else? And it feels like we have different variations of this conversation every year. Obviously, we want the teams to be perfect, and that's the goal, even though it's impossible. But I think when a good chunk of your roster isn't performing to projection, then that's something that you really need to investigate and dig in on.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, ICAP's one guy who's, you know, gotten, but his projection was pretty modest. Vlad's right around the same spot in terms of OPS plus, but he's traded a bunch of slug for OBP. You know, are you okay with that? What do you make of that? So I look forward to reading that that article, Shai. Last thing on something you wrote recently to tie into these offensive struggles. Jose Bautista interested in coming back and being a right-handed bat? I saw some of those batting practice clips, man. I know you talked to him a little bit on the weekend.
Yeah, that was he fouled off about four or five straight pitches, and then he sent one down the left field line, and he just came out of the cage after he looked at me just shaking his head. I'm like, man, that was rusty. So it was kind of funny at the City Connect reveal party. He was looking at himself. He goes, putting this on, he's like, I almost feel like I could play again. He goes, but I know I definitely can. So I wouldn't worry about that occurring. But he's the owner of a soccer team right now, the United Soccer League, the Las Vegas Lights FC. And so he's branched out into ownership, and he was certainly enjoying the reveal of the City Connect jerseys from the standpoint of what it means for the Blue Jays franchise. But there was a part of him that was kind of looking at it through an ownership lens too, understanding the connection between uniforms and team identity and place in the market and all those things as well.
Okay. So Shai, that's a lot of fun. Glad you got to catch up with Jose. The clips were awesome that were floating around. You tweeted something while you were on air with us, which I'm impressed by. We have confirmation now of what we kind of assume, which is that Trevor Richards will start tonight. I imagine Bowden Francis will be activated at some point to play a bulk role there. How do you foresee the Jays setting things up tonight against the Orioles?
Yeah, I mean, I'd imagine they'd want Trevor Richards to go as long as he could. Did a really nice job on an emergency basis behind Alec Manoah the other week last week in Chicago. And he got stretched out to, forgive me, I don't know the exact number, I think it was in the neighborhood of 55 to 60 pitches. In that outing. And so the Blue Jays could look to get him there again against the Orioles. And certainly with a lot of left-handed hitters who do some damage, that changeup could be a weapon in trying to neutralize them. But Bowden Francis, there are no plans for him to get into a rehab game anytime soon. So he's got a pitch in the near future. So you would assume that he would be activated and be available. The Blue Jays try to create some length in their bullpen. If you're taking Trevor Richards out of that mix, then Bowden Francis seems like the guy to come in and replace him. And you know, the Blue Jays have about 20 starts in the Alec Manoah spot to figure out for the rest of the year. I'm not sure that this is letting Trevor Richards fly with it. is sustainable longer term. So they're going to need an answer. I think Yariel Rodriguez, at least for a portion of time, will be part of that answer once he's ready. But he's not due to start until or have another rehab outing at AAA Buffalo. He's going to come out of the bullpen tomorrow. And then from that point forward, we'll see how the Blue Jays try to piece all the pitching options together.
Yeah, Bowden Francis got up to 60 pitches kind of out of the bullpen in his last rehab outing, which was a while ago now. So he should be good to go if they activate him. You mentioned Yariel Rodriguez. They're going to try to get him 55-ish pitches out of the pen. So he's right. You know, we've obviously seen him start. Maybe they have him ready for a Bowden Francis-like bulk roll as well. Longer term, you know, obviously there is a cost to your bullpen of losing Trevor Richards at a time when you also don't have Romano and Swanson. And I don't mean you like lose Richards. He threw 11 pitches out of the bullpen on Sunday. You could probably get one inning from him somewhere in between his kind of opener starts. But what does this bullpen look like behind Jimmy Garcia now if Richards, who's been probably your second best healthy reliever right now, is now going to be tabbed for, you know, hey, we need him to open every fifth day?
Yeah, well, I mean, the Blue Jays in some ways are back to where they were at the beginning of the year when Romano and Swanson were on the IL. So they've got Green and Jimmy Garcia for your highest of leverage at the end of the game. But like you mentioned, you know, Trevor Richards is in between roles right now, and you need him in this bulk positioning because you don't have a fifth starter. And this is something that the Blue Jays experienced last summer when Alec Manoah was down at AAA trying to get himself right. And that's a really tough spot. And again, you're thinned out because you don't have Romano, you don't have Swanson in the mix. Tim Mesa and Yenesis Cabrera, two guys you relied on pretty heavily, have both been hit or miss a little bit so far this season. So that's not working. You've got Zach Pop and Nate Pearson who have had their moments and then have had their struggles as well. And so the Blue Jays aren't in a great spot. There's a lot of opportunity right now if someone wants to grab a high leverage role and run with it. And I also wonder, like, at some point, I know right now they want Yariel Rodriguez for bulk and they want to try to get him some consistent work. But this is also a guy who's got some closing experience and some high leverage experience as a reliever in Japan. So he knows the moment. He certainly has the stuff for it. If things don't stabilize with some of your other guys, could you end up turning to Yariel Rodriguez there? And I think, I would say that in all the conversations I've had with people around the team, for now, they want to try to extend him as much as they can because they do want to give him an opportunity to be a starter next year. But the big league need is the big league need. And, you know, they're in a position where they're trying to rescue the season. You may have to sacrifice some of the things you're hoping for next year to try and optimize this year as much as you can while you still have a chance to save the year.
Yeah, while you still have a chance is a great way to end that note, Shai, because, yeah, it won't matter that much what Yariel Rodriguez's role is in August if things don't go well this next month and a half here. Well, it'll matter, but it won't matter to the same extent. Shai, before I let you go here, appreciate your time. Last night was the second lowest attendance figure at home of the season, and this is relevant because you track how many hot dogs are eaten at the Rogers Center on each Looney Dog night. So if we assume that, you know, the attendance is going to be around that level, maybe we don't want to look at the total hot dog number. You have developed a hot dog per minute metric here. What are we expecting tonight? Do you think a lower attendance could push your hot dog per minute metric higher since the lines would theoretically be shorter?
It's interesting. You know, Blake, you've been in the press box a few times. I've bounced around different ideas for certain metrics. Our weighted expected hot dogs never really found the mark. So never saw and won't see the light of day, at least for the time being. It's really interesting. I would think that the dog per minute will be relatively stable because a lot of people who come do come to eat the hot dogs. And that's at least part of the experience, and there's intent to do some damage on that count, both to themselves and to their wallets. But I'm not sure, to be honest. There also is always a little bit of an uptick on the Looney Dog night. People do seem to quite enjoy this event, and it's something that seems to be circled on the calendars for people, and good for them. So we'll see. I mean, we're too early into the new metric to assume any trends. So we'll wait and see until we have a better sample of data to draw any conclusions.
All right, bat speed and hot dog per minute. We got to expand the sample here, see some year over year correlations and things like that. Shai Davidi, thanks so much for taking the time this morning, man.
Anytime, Blake. Be well.
Shai Davidi of Sportsnet.ca. And yeah, note within there, if you missed it, Trevor Richards will start tonight. We don't have the official roster move yet, but we presume Bowden Francis will be a big part of how the Jays are shaping up for this one. Let's take a break. When we come back, let's get the Orioles side of this. We know Corbin Burnes is starting tonight. We know a lot about Corbin Burnes. We saw him earlier this year. He is nasty. That cutter is ridiculous. I don't know that the Jays are going to have the best of times hitting, but the Orioles have some TBAs of their own later in this series. We assume Albert Suarez is going to be one of those. Kyle Bradish is going to be one of those. But the Orioles are in a bit of a triage situation of their own when it comes to the starting rotation. Let's take a break. Let's talk to Jeff Arnold, Orioles play-by-play voice for Masson, when we come back. And Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. That's Turnstile, a little Baltimore music for you, although you're probably sick of Baltimore. Just one game into a four-game series here. Jays lose 7-2 last night. They'll get back in action tonight at 7:07 down at the Rogers Center. It'll be Corbin Burnes on one side. It'll be Trevor Richards starting on the other side. We found out just a little bit ago. It'll be Dan, Buck, Hazel, and Emily with you on the TV side. Jamie and Joe for Blue Jay Central. Shai Davidi, who we just spoke to, and Ben Nicholson-Smith down at the park writing. And Eric Smith is going to fill in for Ben Shulman alongside Chris LaRue on the radio call tonight. Ben Shulman gutted it out with us yesterday, out with an illness tonight. So I hope he gets better soon, and appreciate him fighting through it yesterday for us. We're going to talk to Jeff Arnold of Masson momentarily here. We do have a couple questions in the text line that came in throughout the show. A couple on Twitter as well. Sean on Twitter suggested Adam Macko for the spot. And yeah, we discussed this pretty at length last week. He is a guy who has very good numbers, has performed very, very well. Only has, though, 49 innings at Double-A, and that's because he only got to Double-A this year because he wasn't throwing, full games. He only just got up to, a full starter's pitch load and only just starting to pitch every fifth day. So my guess is the Jays will continue to play that slow. He was on like a 6 or 7 day between start stretch to begin the season. Had a couple starts that were, didn't even go 5 innings. So it seems like they're going to be methodical with him. The numbers are very good, but it's only 49 innings at Double-A. This team has been pretty slow with those kind of things in the past. So maybe a Triple-A stint is in the mix for Macko sometime soon. I'd be a little surprised unless things got really dire if they hot-shotted him right to the majors after just 49 innings at Double-A. But look, desperate times call for desperate measures, and he has very good stuff. Not so desperate are the Baltimore Orioles, although they're dealing with some starting pitching triage of their own. Jeff Arnold, Orioles play-by-play voice for Masson, joins us now to talk about it. Jeff, how we doing, man?
Doing well. How are you?
I am. I'm pretty good. I would have been better if Austin Hayes didn't start his season last night for the Orioles. Man, two home runs, his first two of the year. I'd imagine you guys were in that clubhouse after that. That's got to feel good for Austin Hayes, a guy who to that point had really been kind of the only Oriole not hitting for power so far this year.
Well, when you look at Austin Hayes, it was kind of a tough start to the year. You go back to spring training, he dealt with this flu that cost him a bunch of at-bats at the very end. Then he got hit on the hand or wrist area in a game, and so he just lost like a couple weeks' worth of at-bats. He got off to a really slow start with us and then ended up suffering a groin injury, so he went down to rehab. He came back, and he's been hitting. I mean, he was mostly making his presence felt off the bench. He was hitting a lot of balls hard, even balls were not hit. And then yesterday, nice to see him get a couple of home runs. I know it's been a frustrating year for him just because this is a guy who was an all-star last year. He started the all-star game last season for the American League. and he just hadn't gotten off to the beginning that he was expecting. But nice to see him put it all together last night, and he played a big role in the Orioles win.
Yeah, he certainly did. Took two Kevin Gausman mistakes for a ride there, and Gausman didn't make a lot of mistakes yesterday, but the Orioles jumped all over what they could. That's kind of what the Orioles do. We know a lot of these guys at this point. Someone we didn't know a lot about, Connor Norby, made his MLB debut last night. Jorge Mateo going on the 7-day concussion IL after that kind of accidental bat from Cedric Mullins in the on-deck circle the other day. Before we get to Norby, though, do you guys have an update? Did you get an update on how Mateo's doing after that incident?
You know, the latest update we had was that, you know, he's in concussion protocol right now. They're hoping that it's going to be just 7 days because Mateo's playing really well for us. He's huge for us defensively. You know, with a concussion, though, you can never quite predict it. But the hope is that it's going to be relatively soon. But because he goes on the concussion IL, it means it opens the door for Connor Norby, who had been lighting it up at AAA and was just waiting for a chance, and finally it came his way.
Yeah, so he was lighting it up, and he gets a chance. It is annoying for non-Orioles teams to look at that the Orioles lose Jorge Mateo, who had been playing so well, and they can sit there and be like, Jackson Holliday, top prospect in all of baseball. Heston Kerstad, who's also tearing it up at AAA. We'll go to Connor Norby. They just keep kind of coming up with these guys. What did you make of their decision to go with Norby instead of a Holliday or Kerstad?
Well, I think that with Kerstad, there's just not a whole lot of room in our outfield. We have so many guys that are there. I mean, Austin Hayes, like I said, he's been struggling to get in. Cedric Mullins has been struggling recently. So it made sense, I think, to go with an infielder. And, you know, Jackson Holliday is starting to hit better at AAA. You know, his first stint with the Orioles was a little problematic where he just didn't hit the ball well. I mean, he missed a lot of fastballs in the zone. And it's just a reminder that no matter how good you are, you can be the best prospect in the game. But when you go from AAA pitching to Major League pitching, it is very, very different. And it's something that we expect Jackson's going to be really good. It was just a tough first in, and that's not unusual. A lot of players are in that boat. But I think with Connor Norby, you have somebody that he'd spent part of three seasons at AAA. He'd done really everything that he needed to do. I really liked what I saw from him at spring training. He had an injury that got him off to a little bit of a slower start. But when he started getting into games, he was barreling everything and hitting the ball really hard. You know, defensively, he's definitely made improvements over at second base. He could play corner outfield if you needed him to. But as I said, we have a pretty big group of outfielders already on our team. I think it was, you know, maybe more about just the fact that this might be a quick stint if Mateo is able to come back soon. Norby obviously doesn't know anything, and neither do we. But it probably is a situation where if you're going to bring Jackson Holliday up, you want him to stay. Versus something like this, where it very well might be a pretty quick stint for Mateo on a concussion IL.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. And you know, Norby didn't get on the board last night, but I'd imagine if they're going to play him every day while he's up here, he'll have some opportunities over the course of this series. The guys at the very top here for the Orioles are fairly well known at this point. Jays fans have probably seen too much of them already in their career, but Gunnar Henderson leading off this lineup, 19 home runs already. There have been a couple stats going around, you know, the Orioles first four hitters in the lineup have more home runs than the entire Blue Jays team, or Gunnar Henderson has more first inning home runs than the entire Blue Jays team. Those, you know, statistical superlatives are a little fun, but when we kind of recalibrate and level set here with Gunnar Henderson, he's only 22, but it's not reactionary or small sample or anything like that. Like, everyone talked about Gunnar Henderson as a future MVP. He should very much be in the discussion right now, right?
I mean, as far as we're concerned, yes. I mean, to us, he is certainly in the MVP conversation right now. He's definitely going to be an all-star for what he's done this year already. And the scary thing is that he hasn't, I don't think, played his best baseball yet. He's still got so much potential. He's still so young. Defensively, he's come a long way as well. He's played some really good shortstop. I think what isn't talked about enough is that usually he makes a play a night defensively where it makes your jaw drop or makes you think, I don't think a whole lot of shortstop across baseball could make that play. Or if they could, they don't make it look as easy as Gunnar is able to do. And then offensively, he's just got a really special skill set. He's not afraid to take a walk. I don't think he really likes taking walks, because whenever he does, he chucks his bat, and sometimes he's hit Brandon Hyde with it, which is kind of funny. But, you know, he's got an immense amount of power. He's a great overall hitter, and the best is yet to come for Gunnar Henderson. I would not be surprised if this year he wins the MVP. I would not be surprised if he wins a couple of MVP awards when he's with the Orioles, but the future is very bright for the Orioles, and Gunnar Henderson is really a big part of it.
You mentioned him not liking to take a walk necessarily. He'd like to have the bat in his hands instead. His kind of co-star here, Adley Rutschman, has maybe taken a cue from him. The walk rate is down significantly for Adley Rutschman. Still never swings at a first pitch. Still, you know, not the most aggressive guy up there, but it does seem like Rutschman has traded in a little bit of that elite on base skill and walk drawing skill to look for a little bit more power, hit for a little bit more average this year. Has that been a conscious change on Rutschman's part, just kind of adjusting to how pitchers have adjusted to him? What do you make of that swing for Rutschman?
Well, you know, what's interesting is you brought it up. He has, I think, the lowest first pitch swing rate in all of baseball, and yet his walk rate is the lowest of his career. So I think it's something that, you know, we've seen this with Adley, we've seen this with Gunnar, we've seen this with other Orioles players. And I think it's something that maybe we're seeing kind of matriculate down to the minor leagues because of the way that the Orioles teach hitting, and they want guys who can make contact, who can hit for power, who can hit for average, who can get on base. But I think what we saw with, in the case of Adley, Gunnar, Colton Cowser last year, was they come up to the major leagues and they were almost too selective when they were at the plate. And what it would mean is you'd be looking at 0-2 a lot. And that's never good when that's happening and you're brand new. So I think right now the emphasis is you want to make sure you're getting good pitches to hit. You want to make sure you get a pitch that you can do damage on. But at the same time, it doesn't have to be 100% perfect to let it fly if you think you can handle the pitch. And that allows you to do some more damage. So I think it's a little bit of a change in philosophy. Not much. It's like you still want to be selective. You still want to be swinging at strikes. But I think now you're in a spot where hitters that the Orioles have, especially young hitters, if you get something that's pretty good that you like, let it go, because that might be the best pitch you see in the at-bat. It helps you avoid those 0-2 counts. And so I think that probably for Adley, it has something to do along those lines. It also just has to do with the fact that he handles the bat really well. He can cover pretty much every quadrant of the strike zone. He's starting to hit for more power. But I would imagine that it probably has something to do with that.
The way you describe the way the Orioles are teaching hitting seems like it sounds like something that the Jays are trying to get back to. They hammered, you know, swing decisions, and now, you know, that ability to jump on stuff and do damage has maybe gone too far to the side. They're trying to get it back here. Don't know that they're going to get it back tonight against Corbin Burnes, who has been, you know, everything the Orioles traded for. 2.35. ERA, all the underlying metrics back that up. Nasty cutter, curveball, slider, changeup, sinker. There's nothing Corbin Burnes really can't throw at you. When you look back at that trade, I know, you know, it took a little bit for the Orioles to get into kind of a win now trade mentality, because they wanted to be patient. They wanted to make sure the core was coming along. And Joey Ortiz is having a nice year, but this has to be looked at as a huge win, and Burnes having delivered everything the Orioles were hoping for so far.
Well, when the Orioles went to the last offseason, they wanted to make sure that they got an ace. And it was something that, you know, Kyle Bradish, I think, could be an ace. I think Grayson Rodriguez could be an ace for this Orioles team. But you have somebody like Corbin Burnes, who is one and who has won a Cy Young. He's been on a lot of all-star teams. He's eaten up a lot of innings. He's pitched in big games. And he was the kind of target that you were looking for. And to go along with that, you know, Corbin Burnes has made it clear, I haven't won a World Series yet, and I definitely want to do that. By coming to the Orioles, he gives himself an opportunity to. As good as he's been, and he has been one of the best in the American League, I don't even know if we've seen the best from Corbin Burnes yet. I mean, there have been a number of outings where, you know, he's grinded through and still giving you six innings of two-run baseball. But every time he's been out there, the Orioles have been in the game. His cutter is as advertised. It is one of the best pitches of its kind in baseball. It's probably the number one cutter in baseball right now, and it's one of the best overall pitches out there. But his slider is nasty. His curveball, he has two types of curves that he throws, one which is more of a banger pitch, which can put you away. But his changeup is really good. He doesn't throw it a lot, but when he does, it's a filthy pitch. So he's got so many weapons that he can throw at you. He's very disciplined. He knows how to pitch. He's really good at saying, this is what works, this is what I do, this is what I do well. And our pitching coaches are there to help him out and support him and communicate with him. But, you know, this is a guy who really knows who he is and what he does, and they let him do it. And, you know, I think he's also kind of a lead by example type of person. We've heard different guys talk about how they just watch Burns and his routine and what he does and how he goes about it and how strict he is and how consistent he is with it. That's something that all our young starters can learn from. But I think in the month of June, you're really going to rely on Burns and this starting group to help you out, because the Orioles have only one off day in the month of June. And so getting Burns to go deeper in outings like Grayson Rodriguez did last night, where he almost makes it through seven innings, that's what you're looking for, because these games mean a lot and you're going to be playing a lot of really tough teams without a whole lot of time off.
And look, Burns can do it. Grayson Rodriguez showed us last night, Kyle Bradish. But there are some injuries to this starting rotation as well. John Means and Tyler Wells are done for the season. Dean Kramer on the IL with a triceps issue. So we've got some TBAs on the probable pitcher list. Jeff, not to put you on the spot too much, but do you anticipate Albert Suarez getting another turn on Wednesday as this series rolls on?
You know, it wouldn't surprise me. I think he's kind of moved back into the rotation for now. Suarez has gone between starting, long relieving, short relieving. We've seen him in high leverage spots that happened when the Orioles were in Washington earlier on this year. I think that his flexibility is really big for you, because he can spin it up there. He's got a really good four-seam fastball with a lot of ride to it. He's very calm on the mound as well. I mean, his first start back was kind of a spot start where we needed somebody, and we put him in there, and he throws four scoreless innings when I don't know if we were expecting him to go that long. It might have taken him 80 pitches, but he still got through it. And last time, five innings, and he made some nice in-game adjustments after, you know, he was going the fastball and he's facing the Rays. They just keep fouling pitches off, and then he started to, you know, work in the breaking balls a little bit more in the changeup. So he definitely knows how to pitch. He's very mature. I wouldn't be surprised if we saw him get a start. And then the Orioles are probably trying to evaluate all their options and look at how things are going, because the next off day, as I said, you have one in June, and it isn't until June 17th. So I'm sure they're trying to be very careful right now. Orioles have also talked about going to a six-man rotation or a modified six-man rotation at some point. So would not be surprised if they went to that at some point this month.
And we're starting to see, you know, when you have this many games in a row, you got to do the back end of the bullpen kind of bullpen churn, I guess. You know, Nick Vespi activated now. Caleb Ort was out. They had Thiago Vieira for a moment. So, yeah, even the teams that are very, very good have to deal with some of this stuff. Jeff Arnold, thank you so much for taking the time out, man. Enjoy the game tonight.
Absolutely. Really appreciate it.
Jeff Arnold, voice of the Orioles on play-by-play at Masson. This series continues 7:07 tonight. Corbin Burns against Trevor Richards, which we now know. So I can change the TBA in my little doc here. Also, my doc here, I have some of your texts. We've got a few minutes to do a couple texts here. We'll do a bunch of them tomorrow as well. So you can send those to 590, 590, as always. Talked a little bit about Adam Macko before Jeff came on. And yeah, he's a guy who certainly, as far as who's performing the best in the minors, he's also on the 40-man. He would be on the radar, but he has only just gotten to, you know, pitching on every fifth day, pitching a full starter's load, etc. Only 49 innings at AA. So I don't know that they'll rush him that much, although you could make a case, because look at where you are. You don't want to do 36 games in 38 days. You're in the middle of right now. This is game five of that stretch, but you don't want to be doing a four-man with two of your bullpen guys set aside for that every day too often and too long for sure. Someone asked a question. There wasn't a name on this one, but where is the body of evidence showing us that Vlad is so much worse than Isaiah Kiner-Falefa at third? Vlad has surprised a lot of people with his athleticism. He's a proud guy. I wonder if you'll get more mojo out of him playing a more dynamic position. The body of evidence is Vlad's 2019 season. That season he graded, and he got like a full season worth of reps there, almost 1,000 innings at third. He graded as not just the worst defensive third baseman in the league, but almost the worst defensive player in the league that year. Defensive metrics are, you know, they're finicky. They change year to year. You know, there was the one year they thought Matt Chapman wasn't actually a very good third baseman. We do have to take these things with a grain of salt, certainly. But he was not very good there in 2019. His ability to come in at balls was a question. Obviously, he had the arm to play there. And to the, this person's point, you know, he does have a little bit of juice, a little bit of verve to how he plays in the field. But yeah, the way we can evaluate these things, and certainly the way I remember it in 2019, he just wasn't very good there. Now, that's not to say he can't be solid there. He's gotten more athletic since then. Obviously done a lot of work on his body. He's shown himself to be a very good first baseman. The arm is still the arm. I'm not against putting him there sometimes. But Isaiah Kiner-Falefa has like 1,500 innings there in his career being, you know, the arm is not great, but we have a pretty long track record of IKF being good defensively at third base. Not exactly sure where that question came from, because Vlad's reps at third base are not really in contrast with IKF's. It's more about the situations where you want both Turner and Vogelbach's bat in the lineup, or one of Turner and Vogelbach and then Danny Jansen at DH. So it's, you know, Isaiah Kiner-Falefa in these situations is not the guy necessarily eating Vlad's third base reps. It's just if you have both of them in the infield, you would certainly rather Vlad be at first base. IKF's more of a, hey, he ends up playing a different position because of all of these other changes. Doug from Burlington says, how many Blue Jays would be in the Orioles starting nine, or named Blue Jays who would start for the Orioles? Potentially Bo, but it would be at second base and not shortstop. Yeah, I mean, he wouldn't start at shortstop. I mentioned a stat earlier that the Orioles have eight guys who play pretty much every day for them who have a slugging percentage of .436 or higher. And that's a random cutoff, but I just picked their worst performing regular, which is Colton Cowser. And the Jays have three of those guys. There are 70 points of slug in difference between the Orioles and the Blue Jays. And most of these guys play their positions pretty well defensively. So, you know, they would probably, even though Ryan Mountcastle is a nice player, I'd imagine they would start Vlad because of the upside there. And then you probably, I don't know, slide Mountcastle to DH instead or something like that. But yeah, there are not a lot of spots. You know, if you're worried about the offense first, maybe you start David Schneider over Colton Cowser in left. Cowser a bit better of a defender out there. But yeah, the Orioles are a better team than the Blue Jays is the point of this question. It's pretty straightforward when you, yes, look at the names on the page, look at the stats on the page, but watch these two teams. They didn't seem like they were on the same level yesterday. Even when they split that two-game series earlier in the year, it felt like the Jays had done everything. Like, to split that series, the Jays were going back to their corner, exhausted, falling onto the stool, you know, ice pack on the back, things like that. And the Orioles were like standing up in their corner, telling their corner man, nah, I don't want the water. I don't need it. I'm good to go another round. That's where the Jays are right now. And this is, you know, these series can be good for that because you test yourself against that and you try to play up to that level. But yeah, the way it looks right now is that this isn't quite Jays versus White Sox, but it's not exactly Orioles versus Yankees either. Ryan on Twitter had asked a little earlier. I responded to him on Twitter, but I'll do it here as well. Do I have a good explanation for what's going on with Bo this year? I don't really, and I know that's a bad answer as an analyst, but Bo has always been a difficult guy to evaluate because when he's successful, when he's thriving, it is counter to a lot of the things we normally hear managers and hitting coaches and things like that talk about. He's just a hitter, and he has such a unique style and approach that it can be hard to diagnose. You know, he's not necessarily chasing a ton more or whiffing a ton more. He leads the league in foul balls, so maybe he's just a tiny bit off, but he's always hit a lot of foul balls, especially in two strike counts. Bichette is a guy who I probably, you know, the numbers aren't there and we're a third of the way into the season, but I imagine he'll find his way back to the level he always kind of ends up at. And again, yeah, I don't have a great explanation because Bo is a pretty unique case to evaluate. Last one here before we wrap up. Alex in the Junction asked yesterday, what kind of dark magic are the Orioles involved with? How are they constantly bringing up these top tier prospects no one has heard of? Are they cloning them in their own undergrad city, a la the Tampa Bay pitchers? Yep. It's a whole thing. I don't know where they keep coming from. I got asked this on Twitter earlier about like, would the Jays have the stomach for a big Orioles style rebuild? The Orioles are not the standard. Like, the Orioles did this incredibly quickly. They did it incredibly inexpensively, and they nailed every single like high pick. Like, there's, I mean, maybe not every single one. I'm sure you could dig around and find like a third round pick they didn't hit, but like their first round picks are all starting in the major leagues and they're all good. Their second round picks are all pretty good and filtering the high levels of the minors. Like, they, on the position player side at least, hit on everything and did it quickly and did it cheaply. That's not the norm. Like, if you are going to do a full teardown, and you can have that opinion, you can want that, whatever, the Orioles are not the team that you should point at and be like, that's what it would look like, because they are the like absolute outlier when it comes to doing this. But yeah, it's pretty annoying that they can do it. All right, we're going to wrap up here. It is Corbin Burnes against a Trevor Richards-led pseudo bullpen day for the Blue Jays, 7:07 down at Rogers Center. Blair and Barker will have you for 4 to 6 as well as post-game. It is not a City Connect night tonight. It's the it's day mode in between the two night modes, even though it's a 7:07 start. Thank you to Jake Mintz for coming on, to Jeff Arnold, to Shai Davidi, to Dan Schulman. Thank you, as always, to Lance Kennedy, Jennifer Rolnick, and Amit Mann behind the glass. And yeah, let's see if the Jays can get a little something going here. It's Corbin Burnes. That didn't go the best for them last time, as you would expect, because Corbin Burnes is Corbin Burnes. But you'd really like to see something else get going here, particularly ending the first inning run drought. Let's see it.